Welcome to another episode of From the Horse Box. I've driven up the beautiful Ceriog Valley this morning to meet our guest, Jonathan Greatorex, who is a civil rights campaigner for the tourism industry in Wales, as well as other aspects of the rural economy, and he's a much in demand speaker on these issues. He's also a musician, choral conductor, and teacher, as well as a one-time website designer. And so he's highly qualified as our country character this month for you to enjoy listening to. So good morning, Jonathan, and thank you very much for agreeing to be our next guest on From the Horse Box.
My absolute pleasure. Good morning,
it's
Claire.
It's wonderful to be here. It's been very stormy, and I imagine the Hand has been a very cosy place in this January storms.
You're absolutely right. It's been just a delight. We really, really has. We've been sort of snuggled up quite warmly in front of the fire. It's been great.
So everybody connected with our podcast would feel at home here. The atmosphere is wonderful at the Hand at Llanarmon in North Wales. The rural pub is a very special place. Do you think it's different from the urban experience?
I think very much so. I mean, we're certainly the sort of hub of the community. And by that, you know, I mean, you know, we're the unofficial bank, the unofficial post office, the unofficial, you know, sort of sorting office. I mean, we've had all sorts delivered, from fridges to tractor tyres to, you know, absolutely everything. All that sort of happens, and you know, it's really, 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 really important part of the village. I think
it's essential for people to be able to get together, isn't it? Especially in recent times. Is there a story behind the name of the Hand?
The Hand, well, it's, if you believe it, I mean, it's a rather gruesome legend of Chirk Castle, which was that the present occupant of Chirk Castle was on his deathbed, and the two sons, no one was quite sure which one was going to inherit, and they had a race, and depending on which version you listen to, it was either the first person to touch the dying father's bed or the castle gates with his hand inherited the estate. One brother fell behind, took out his sword, chopped off his hand and lobbed it at the gate or the bed, depending on which version. I'm not sure whether it's true or not, but anyway, it makes for a gruesome story.
Do people ask about that at the bar, or does it make a good conversation starter?
Absolutely. In fact, we've got a piece of paper now that we can hand out and sort of, you know, give people away to take away with them the legend. So yeah, it's quite good.
So you and Jackie, your wife, you head up the team here, and you offer a lovely experience for, you know, for all your visitors. Are you backed up by the Welsh Government with the tourism agencies, or is there a story behind this?
Yeah, I mean, I once famously described Visit Wales as a self-licking ice cream, and Welsh Government pretty much are in the same sort of category, in my opinion, as that. I mean, you know, they are constantly coming up with new and inventive ways to sort of destroy tourism in Wales, you know, from tourist tax, which that were coming in, or they're trying to bring in a couple of years' time, to, you know, everyone driving around at 20 miles an hour. They're bringing in this year visitor registration. You know, it's endless, and you know, from you know, the penal, you know, the way that they're penalising holiday cottage owners. You know, they don't see that, you know, if you own a holiday cottage, you know, chances are that the local plumber's getting work out of that, the local shop, the local pub's getting business out of it. They're certainly not tourism friendly, that's for sure.
So you're quite a leading vocalist on these issues. Do you find people flock to you for help?
Very much so. Yeah, very much so. I get phone calls on an almost daily basis from people who are frustrated, who are, you know, upset, who are in some cases very frightened, you know, because some of the regulations that are coming in are really quite challenging for small businesses, you know. And certainly, you know, just this year alone, in April, we see the Business Recycling Act, which is a great thing. You know, I've been a keen recycler, keen environmentalist, and we were the first people to, pretty much that I know of, to ban plastic straws, you know, and everyone laughed at me for doing it. But actually, you know, it turns out I was right. But this Recycling Act that they're bringing in means that all the rubbish has got to be separated, which is fine, you know, on the face of it. But of course, what that means in reality is that if guests put, let's just say, a bottle, a glass bottle, an aluminium tin can and a plastic sandwich wrapper in the bin in their rooms, my staff now have got to go through that and go through the rooms and separate this rubbish out. And that really hasn't been thought out. And, you know, what happens if there's an insulin injector pen in there? You know, are they at risk? And it's not quite so bad for us, but imagine if you've got a sort of 200, you know, static caravan park that every single bin's got to go through. So Welsh Government they're very good at implementing these ideas, but unfortunately...
Mm. It's a law of unintended consequences. There do seem to be a few things that are not liked by the Welsh Government in general about rural life. They don't seem to like farming and horse riding, and you mentioned sheepdogs. I mean, why do you think this is, that there's a general feeling against this rural community life as that we are seeing?
I think because Welsh Government are so Cardiff-centric, you know, it's just extraordinary. And you know, there is this war, and it feels like a war against the country way of life, you know, from farming, you know, that they've already made it clear that they want to ban pheasant shooting. They want to ban angling. Horse riding is something that they've got their sights on. You know, if you go,
which is another tourism thing.
Absolutely. You know, we have a fabulous local riding schools, you know, at Spring Hill, who bring us a huge amount of business over the summer months. And, you know, we're very grateful for that. But there's this war. They just don't understand it. And I think the problem is that there's no genuine opposition for Welsh Government in Wales. You know, Plaid Cymru immediately got into bed with them, having said they weren't going to do that. And no one's standing up for us, you know, the people who aren't in Cardiff or are in the valleys. You know, we only have to look at the amount of money that's been spent, you know, on Cardiff Bay.
For example, what has been spent?
Well, for example, they're spending millions of pounds now on a metro line connecting Cardiff to Cardiff Bay. You know, you can walk that in 20 minutes. You know, it doesn't need to be done.
And you mentioned the bugs that they're...
Oh, yes, yeah, it was brilliant. £240,000, I think, on bugs for school children to eat in two trial schools.
So they don't want them to eat the farmers' produce.
Oh, God, now, perish the thought that we'd be eating our wonderful Welsh produce. You know, that would be unthinkable. And this is just the lunacy that we're seeing.
So when you protest in channels that you can, what sort of response in return do you get from them?
Well, I've had the police here asking me to be nice to Mr. Drakeford. I've had that happen. I've had phone calls from his office telling me that I'd gone too far with media appearances when I did Channel 4. Sorry, BBC Radio 4 World at One. You know, they just don't like it, and they're not used to
being challenged,
and they are painfully vindictive. There's no two ways about it. But it's staggering. You know, we really do live in a dictatorship here in Wales, and woe betide anyone who dares to challenge the machine.
So it takes quite a lot to put your head above the parapet and stand up for people. Because people need leaders, and you know, it is when you look around. You know, we are maybe, are we short of leaders to
I think
to vocalise these
yes,
things?
I think we are. I don't think, you know, there isn't a strong enough representation, certainly not for hospitality in Wales, in even in the way that they have it across the border in England. You know, and I think the problem we've got is that, you know, as we've seen with the Tata Steel issue that's happening at the moment, you know, where 3,000 people are losing their jobs, and that's horrific. It's absolutely horrific. But of course, this is as a result of the fact that, you know, there's a net zero, you know, sort of goals that have been set by Welsh Government. You know, they've turned around and said that jobs will be lost unless we hit net zero. And of course, what's happening is that jobs are being lost because we're hitting net zero, and that's, you know, that's tragic. But unfortunately, you know, the steel industry's got very strong unions who actually donate to many people in the Welsh Government. We don't have that in hospitality. So we're kind of standing on our own two feet. And you know, let's not forget that about 160,000 people in Wales are employed in hospitality. It's a staggering number. So, you know, they do ignore us at their peril, really.
So the situation in Wales is a sort of microcosm of what, you know, we do need to look very carefully at what's going on. I mean, that, you know, I did see on one lone news channel protest in Europe, which isn't being very highly reported. So it does seem to be a sort of general, you know, biting the hand that feeds you.
Yeah, it seems to be. I mean, if I was a conspiracy theorist, you'd sort of think that there's some sort of, you know, greater, more evil power that's you know, got an agenda. I'm not sure. It certainly seems that way. And it certainly seems as though, you know, we are being coerced. I certainly think that net zero is the new COVID, where everyone sort of complied. It's frightening. So anyway, you know, we'll see. But I'll keep battling from my end. Either way.
We've got to look at some light at the end of the tunnel. I know you're involved in advisory capacity for the tourism trade. You do attend meetings, don't you, in Whitehall?
Yeah.
What can you see that might help? Is there anything that...
What the industry is calling for, what we desperately need, of course, is a cut on that. Because, you know, 20% on everything that we do is just making life unbearable at the moment. And, you know, we are being expected to absorb costs ourselves, and we can't do it anymore. And that 20% that we're handing over to the VAT man every month is just too much money. And everyone says, oh, well, you're not going to use it to cut costs. No, we're not going to use it to cut costs. But what it means is that the increase that we're having are only going to be smaller that we're going to pass on to the customers, as opposed to the fact that we're going to have to pass huge increases on to the customer. And I'll tell you how that looks in real terms. So my electricity bill for this little pub in the middle of nowhere for the month of April 2022 was £1,600. In April 2023, that had gone up to £8,100 for 1 month. And, you know, these numbers are not survivable.
No.
I've mitigated, we put in a massive solar system, but the reality is that, you know, the government's got to start waking up. You know, we're, 24 days into January at the moment, and well over 1,000 hospitality businesses have closed their doors permanently.
And these community places are vital for human beings. We need sociability, you know, mental health's an issue, we need somewhere to be. Do you think they will listen?
I don't know. I hope they will listen for everyone's sake, because, you know, the last thing we want is just, you know, Wetherspoons and, you know, an Amazon restaurant, you know, or, you know,
yes,
McDonald's,
yeah.
Where everything's run by one big corporation. We need...
So your industry really does mirror the farming industry in
very,
that it's been squeezed like
very
this.
Much so, very much so. And
it's,
of course,
very much connected.
Yeah. And we, you know, we buy our meat locally. You know, it's important to support the farming industry. It is.
But you haven't always run a country pub, have you? Although you're a native Welshman and you speak Welsh,
yep,
brought up in Wales,
yep,
you haven't always lived in Wales. You were in London. How did that happen?
Well,
what did you do there?
I was 18 and I went to the London College of Music to study, which I did for 3 years. And then I taught music for about 20 years, I suppose.
So what instruments do you play?
So I was a pianist, an organist and a conductor, a choral conductor. But I taught, I was a classroom music specialist, so I taught.
What
I taught
age?
Music, primary, so from nursery to year six. And I loved it, absolutely loved it. And my wife, we left London. My daughter was turning 13, going on to year 7, 12. And we decided that I didn't really want to bring up a teenage girl in South London, because it was becoming a very different place to how it was when we first moved to London. And so we moved back to Wales, back to my family home, which my daughter was furious about, but there we are.
So this musical ability you have, is that because you're Welsh, because you have this innate, you know, Welshness?
Yeah, I don't know. I think people will say, how did you end up becoming a musician? And I think it's probably because I was fundamentally lazy and I found it very, very easy. It was a lot easier than you know, doing anything more sort of grown up.
But were you brought up with the voice choirs then?
Yes. So I won a choral scholarship at the age of 10. So I went to Way, there was boarding school, to Llandaff Cathedral. And then I won an organ scholarship, actually, to Christ College, where I played the organ and sang in the choir and did all sorts of things. And then, so it's been with me ever, you know.
It must bring you a lot of pleasure, that that ability.
It does. It really does. It's a great thing to be able to do. And I mean, you know, I do it a lot less now, obviously, than I used to do.
Does it enter into your wonderful hospitality in pub? Does it come
It does. It's carols by candlelight on Christmas Eve has become a tradition here at the Hand. You know, it started off with about half a dozen people, and now we get about 60 or 70 people turn up, and it's a lot of people say it's the start to the Christmas.
It fits in very well, doesn't it? It all fits in very well. And do you find that your teaching skills are useful in the pub, you know, crowd control or...
Dealing with difficult customers. Yeah, sort of when I have to...
Do you get any difficult customers?
Oh, well, occasionally you get the odd one or two. I mean, you're always going to in any business. But on the whole, we're lucky. You know, most people come to us because they want to enjoy themselves. You know, I'm not sort of taking taxes or taking parking fines or, you know, sort of, you know, they're coming here because they want to have a bit of fun. So, yeah, it works.
It certainly does. Now, there's another section that's interesting too. You also love computers.
Yes.
And you taught yourself web design. I mean, in the very, very early days of, you know, everyone wanting a website, that also came easily to you.
Yeah, I mean, I'd always had a sort of interest in computers, and you know, a friend of mine was leaving teaching to start a business, and he said, "Will you build me a website?" And I said, "I wouldn't have a clue how to do it." And he said, "Well, I bought me the software, which was a thing called Microsoft Front Page back then, and I built this website, and remarkably, and I don't know how, but it worked." And he started recommending me to a few of his friends and clients, and suddenly I was coming home from school at sort of, you know, 5-6 o'clock, staying up all night till sort of midnight writing websites for people, and this sort of grew and grew and grew.
Do you still do it now?
I do our website, but I don't do anyone else's websites anymore now, and that's it.
So how much does all this sort of technology help you in the business, the website knowledge and the social media? How much does it help you now?
It's hugely important, you know, because, you know, everything now that we do is done on computers, you know, from taking bookings, you know, whether that, you know, room bookings, whether that comes in through booking.com or Expedia, or, you know, someone just, you know, when you arrived this morning, I was taking a booking over the phone, you know, the good old fashioned way. That's all obviously done by computer. All our restaurant bookings are managed by computers. You know, our telephone system is managed by computers. You know, our credit card system goes over, you know, so literally everything is now done that way. And certainly social media is a very powerful marketing tool for us.
Do you have a sort of big community around the social media?
Yeah, we've got quite a few thousand sort of followers. We've got a few thousand people on our mailing list, you know, our email list, and it's a new way of communicating with people. I mean, you know,
do you delegate that, or do you do all that yourself?
I delegate a lot of the Instagram stuff to the chefs in the front of house. I tend to do the sort of, you know, sort of the Facebook stuff, and certainly the Twitter stuff, that's important as well.
Mm-hmm.
That tends to be me. I tend to be Mr. Marketing, I suppose.
Marketing is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And there's always interesting things and avenues. I mean, do you find the coffee and the cocktails dovetails into what you sell?
I mean, we tend not to do a lot of, I tend to steer away from cocktails because it's just the bar can be so busy on a busy night, you know. We've just got, you know, sort of normal things, but coffee is huge.
Yes,
I mean,
it is.
It's massive for us, and I'm a real coffee
so am I.
One of the few things I refuse to do is drink bad coffee, and you know, for us it's really, really important. And we work very closely with two coffee producers, and in fact we actually the hand blend I actually designed myself. We went to an amazing coffee roasters in Liverpool called Joe Black's, and we sat with them and said, right, you know, let's try that, let's try a bit of that, try a bit of that. So we actually came up with the hand blend.
Which is what I've just
which
had.
Which we've had, yeah.
I can recommend it. That's lovely.
And we also work with a brilliant company called Reju 42 as well, who make just the best coffee as well. So those two coffees we're really proud of. And, you know, it gives us, you know, a little bit of a market edge, I suppose.
Definitely, it's a great pleasure. You know, breakfast and brunch and coffee is a you know, hugely pleasurable thing for people.
It is, and you know, it's certainly, you know, we get a lot of, you know, walkers coming in, people coming in, cyclists, you know, and you know, if they've walked, you know, for 2 hours, you know, sitting down with a nice cup of coffee or hot chocolate, or you know, whether it's a cappuccino or a latte, or it doesn't matter, you know, is really important.
Yeah, and highly recommended.
Oh, bless you.
But you know, it's lovely to have this conversation with you now, and conversations and country pubs, and you know, it's the staff of life. I watched an interview, Oliver Reed. I mean, you wouldn't copy everything Oliver Reed does, but he said in one of his interviews, when questioned about his drinking, that, you know, the best, you can find the best people in pubs, and it does seem to help people socialise and tackle loneliness. A tiny bit of alcohol helps people connect.
Absolutely, it's so important, and you know, it was very telling. You know, during the lockdowns, you know, we had the first lockdown. You know, you'll remember that time when people were sort of panic buying toilet rolls, and it was very, very
frightening.
It was terrifying.
It was frightening.
And I took the decision early on, before it became trendy, before everyone started doing that, that actually we were in a very isolated rural community, and I kind of felt that people needed to be fed. And so we started doing, actually, cost price. In fact, actually, it was below cost price, because it cost me about 20 grand to do it. But below cost price takeaways, where people would come and, you know, they would, you know, collect, I mean, all those socially distanced takeaways and all that stuff that we did. We were doing about sort of 30, 40 takeaways every night of the week. And it was important, because it kept the community together. And then when the rules were slightly more restricted, you know, my locals were on the phone saying, you know, Jonathan, we want to come out for a pint. And it was at the stage where
people getting desperate.
People were just getting desperate just to socialise, and they weren't allowed indoors. So we had a window at the side of the hotel that we were allowed to serve pints of beer out of. And this is true. And, you know, it was bonkers, you know, looking back at it. You know, how we had to use plastic glasses because, you know, everyone thought there was a risk of contamination.
And it just shows, you know, we've got to look after these country pubs, and we've got to cling on to our traditions.
We absolutely
very
have
much
got to.
So. I'd just like to do some quick fire questions,
right,
Jonathan. I'm really looking forward to these.
Right, okay.
Your most memorable event or celebration at the hand?
Well,
what occasion sticks in the memory?
There's a couple, I suppose. First of all, I'd say probably every wedding that we've ever done here, which, you know, each of them have been magical events, because we only tend to do weddings for very, very small weddings, and they're very intimate and they're very lovely. So I'd say every single one of the weddings we've ever done has been magical.
I can imagine.
And we had the 50th birthday of a member of our staff, Diana. And that was a great event. They had a bucking bronco and they had live music. And what was brilliant about that is that Diana is an interrogator, and her partner, Johan, managed to keep this you know, as a surprise, which, if you know Diana, was no mean feat. So that was a great one as well.
That sounds wonderful. A favourite or most uplifting piece of music, and why?
Gosh. Probably my favourite would have to be I Was Glad by Parry, because it's just wonderful. It's one of my favourite pieces of music, and I just adore it. I just love it. Just love her.
Now, your desert island disc, luxury item. Ooh. For being cast away.
I think,
what could you not do without?
I think it would have to be, and this is going to sound a bit girly, but it would be a good moisturiser. Top tip there, guys. Always moisturise. You know, it's important.
Well, I know where you're coming from there. And lastly, we ask all our guests for a joke or a motto
Share. Let me think. Well, I would say wine. It's not just a breakfast food. You can enjoy it at any time of the day.
Wow.
Top tip.
Absolutely. Why is I Was Glad by Hubert Parry Jonathan's favourite? Shall we have a very quick listen? Thank you so much, Jonathan, for such an enjoyable morning. It is much appreciated. And thank you for listening. We look forward to next time, when it could be you in the driving seat.